Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
And this is Peter Bregan. And again, hello to the best audience in the world. People, all of you on the cutting edge, thinking about whatever your interest is in this field, this broad field of psychology and psychiatry and mental health and branching off into psychology and sociology and the human sciences. That's why the first journal I founded, the only journal I founded, I called Ethical Human Psychology and, I call it Ethical Human Services, but it got changed. Listen, I'm really glad to be here. I'm really, really glad to have this show. Today I'm going to be talking with a good friend of mine, but before I tell you about him, I want to tell you about next week, because I'm having a psychiatrist on whom I greatly admire, and many of you know of him. His name is Bruce Perry, Bruce D. Perry. He's both an MD and a PhD, and he has written really good stuff and said really good stuff about the importance of childhood trauma, which of course immediately snatches him out of the mainstream of psychiatry. And he's done work in child development and made sensible inroads into thinking about brain function, not to these bizarre, I'm selling you a new form of diagnosing ADHD with a MRI or something, but seriously looking at the development of the brain and the development of human attachment. He's a very thoughtful man. And I'm really pleased to be coming on next week on February 7th. But now, my friend, Howie Glasser. Howie, are you there?
I am here, Peter. It's great to be here with you.
It is. Howie, you are one of the guests that I have on that I'm always shocked to see you've only been on about four times in the past, and you haven't been on in about a year or two. I talk to you in my head more than I have you on my show, which doesn't seem like the right thing, but I'm really, really glad to have you on again. And if I let us go too long, you just give me a buzz and say, hey, Peter, let me come on and talk. I've got some stuff going on. Many of you know Howie. He's the if you've been to my conferences in the past, you know Howie, because I had him often at our conferences. He's certainly an empathic therapist, an empathic educator. Howie is the creator of the Nurtured Heart approach to helping children and to psychotherapy and to education. And he'll tell you about the principles today, but they have a lot to do with empowering children, a lot to do with teaching kids or helping kids find their greatness, what he calls their greatness. And it's a wonderful approach to thinking about children. And Howie is somebody who's an entrepreneur and increasingly becoming a scientist. He is subjecting his approach to testing. And I think that's going to be really, really interesting. And he's got research programs looking at him from Rutgers, from the University of Arizona. So I think this is going to be a new future of actually looking at, are we really helping people? Howie, I was thinking about it the other day. I think about patients I've helped, but I have very little follow-up on them. I don't intrude on their lives. I don't send them Christmas cards. I don't call him and say, where you been? How you doing? I come from that old school of therapy in that regard. And I get follow-up probably more often when they're not doing too well and they want to come back for a while. Occasionally I'll bump into somebody when I moved to Ithaca 17 years ago. A patient of mine from about 20 years ago came to hear me talk and spoke of just how much he'd learned all those years ago and how what good stead it helped him. So, you know, I wish that I had developed early on some sort of concept of follow-up. I'm really glad to see that you are actually going to go ahead and test your approach. But start out first and maybe just talk about who you are and what you do. And I'm going to give you the mic now.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for that beautiful introduction. It's such a pleasure to, I'm so honored to know you, and you are the conscience of psychiatry, and psychiatry needs a voice. It needs its conscientiousness to navigate through all the questions and all the pain that's out there. So what I do is I teach people that intensity, that life force is really energy, and that kids have an uncanny ability to read energy and to watch the truth of energy. And, you know, we could say all day long we like respect, and we want our kids to be respectful. But if a kid watches the truth of our energy, reality at the level of energy, and they see that we get more excited about them when they're not being respectful. If they see that when they are being respectful, we let it go, and our appreciation is negligible, if any. And when they're not respectful, that's when we lean in and get excited and we have so much to say. They measure us by way of that truth. And they, if they're highly intense, they're highly needy and highly craving relationship. And if that's how they find their way to better broadband relationship, that's how they find it. And they wind, some kids wind up creating lives around that and patterns around that. So my work is in teaching parents how to extricate themselves from that pattern, as well as therapists, as well as educators, and other treatment professionals. And to just add a little, so that all is called the nurtured heart approach. It's really a belief that intensity is a gift, and the same intensity that drives people crazy, the same intensity that goes awry, is the very same intensity that's the source of the child's greatness. And for some reason, I've been given a gift of interesting ways of explaining that to people. So about 3 years ago, some people I've trained in this approach, I certified them to teach this approach. They had connections and ins with Rutgers University and the system of care in New Jersey. And this is interesting that Bruce Perry is going to be a guest next week, because one of the paradigms that the state of New Jersey follows for all foster and adoptive kids, for all kids in group homes and residential treatment programs, is a lot of Bruce Perry's beautiful work, which I admire. And then by way of some people have trained with me, they convinced the system to go after a SAMHSA grant, which they got. And for the last 3 years, we've been training trainers of the nurtured heart approach in the state of New Jersey for the system of care. And it's gone really well. It's gone so well that now we have other places looking at what we do. And we've just gotten a couple of those initiatives off the ground. So, you know, Rutgers is going to do the follow-up, and they're going to be seeing if there's, you know, everything from a difference in cost, cost-benefit to benefit for the children. And hopefully we'll have that in the next couple of years.
Describe what you're doing at Rutgers in the training. Give us more detail. I think people like, you know, be good if they can sort of be there with you, get a feeling what's like to be training.
Well, I could give you a little glimpse of it. You know, my work, even though I trained in clinical psychology, you know, my work and very complex approaches, my work really relies on simplicity, and a lot of the way I teach is through stories and metaphor. So I'll give you an example. I think I'm going to start with look at how kids play video games. Some kids who can't concentrate on their important stuff, their chores, their responsibilities, their assignments for 5 minutes. They get on games and they are stars. So all they want to do is go level, 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 greatest in the world. And I've looked at that. I would try to figure out what is it about these games. I'm not a fan of these games. I'm just in awe of how well these kids can give themselves over fully despite, you know, all the problems they have, how fraught their life is with difficulties and challenges when it comes to the real world. And so I'm going to give you a metaphor for that maybe will bring you to see that the games are essentially working on a different principle. It's different. The structure is different. The incentives contradict real life. The consequences contradict real life. So imagine me being one of these kids playing one of these games right now. And at the moment, I'm going toward the goals and I'm getting the goals. And while I'm avoiding the pitfalls, I'm not breaking the rules. And while I'm doing that, every step of the way, the game's in my face, confronting me with my success. And any next second, I'm free to break a rule. And if I do, the game never hesitates to call me on it. It doesn't say, oh, Howie's having a good day. Let's not interfere. Or Howie's having a bad day. Let's let this one go. It, no matter what, it always delivers. And we look at these consequences as drastic, bombs bursting, heads, blood spurting. But who's back in the game in 2 seconds? The game is. I mean, the child is. Even if the game's over, who's back in the game in 2 seconds? So the interesting thing is the game desires the child to be back in the game because that's where the action is and that's where the compelling nature of the game is, the success nature of the game. So the child thinks they had a consequence. For the child, 2 seconds felt like an eternity. So they have these games have a whole different view on consequences. They are not punitive. They're designed to usher the child back into their greatness. And the action where the growth is game in, game on. And if game in, game on is powerful enough, game out has all the power in the world because all the child wants to do is not only get back in the game, but be better than ever. They want to come back and not only not break that rule again, but they just want to go even further. So they are able to channel their great energies into greatness, what I would call greatness. And so what I like to do, if I translate that story, is I like to teach people how to be proactive, how to see their way to how to see their way to a child, how to see with their heart, how to see just the way you do, Peter, and you've always done this, how to see with their heart into what the child is doing that is the things we want to teach all the time. You know, so instead of being mute when a child's being respectful, I teach a parent how to, you know, capture that in a way a child could hear that. So I teach them to see the detail. Billy, I really like how you gave your sister space. You didn't have you had your music low. It allowed her to do her homework. You were, by way of doing that, you were being thoughtful and considerate, and that's great respect I see in you. And so I like teaching kids that it's not a question of whether they can or can't. Here you are being this quality, and this quality is an aspect of your greatness. And kids, Peter, kids rise to that occasion. We're seeing kids in these group homes and residential treatment programs that are coming out of their shell, that are coming out of their fog, that are really beginning to show up as leaders and use their intensity really well.
I hear you. And I think it's incredibly important. I wonder about, you know, our more traditional psychotherapeutic approach, which focuses on problems and their origins and overcoming them, doesn't to some extent reinforce that. Whereas what you're trying to do very, very directly is avoid rewarding with energy and time and interest and love and so on, bad behavior, and instead to pour it onto good behavior. Is that a fair, quick summary?
Yeah, absolutely. And when a line is crossed, I have a way of teaching parents how to say reset to the child, where essentially the parent unplugs their relationship. They just say reset, which conveys the consequence. The consequence is a loss of connection. And so what the parent then does is they stay alert to when the rule is no longer being broken. So for instance, if a child's being rude and crosses a line, if there is a rule, no being rude, or whether or not they have that rule, if a child's being rude, the parent says reset without any hesitation, turns away, unplugs themselves. And as soon as the child stops being rude, the parent purposefully turns back and says, thank you for stopping. Thank you for doing your consequence. Thank you for now showing respect. Now you're not being rude. Now you're not talking back. Now you're not using bad language. And that shows me your compassion. That shows me your desire to contribute to this family with kindness. That's an act of your kindness. You know, I am going overboard because I look at how we think nothing of going overboard when a child acts out. You know, we say we're busy, but we're never too busy for a problem, are we?
to get mad, just to flat out get mad.
Yeah. So we wind up giving this energized energy when things go wrong. Why not give energized energy when things are going right? And that's my premise. That's essentially, you know, the nuts and bolts of nurtured heart approach. Don't give, you know, three stands. One, I'm not going to give any energy to negativity. I'm not going to give the gift of my relationship to negativity. Two, I will give all I got to every ounce of things I see in the right direction. I'm going to call you out on all the good qualities, and I'm going to give evidence. And the third thing is, if you break a rule, if you cross a line, that's no problem. I'm going to just say reset. I'm going to give you a consequence every time, no warning. So it's a different way of playing hardball, Peter. But what we're finding is, and we're going to know. We're going to know empirically soon, because whether it has the viability that a lot of people think it has, Today marks the day that the University of Arizona starts its research on how nurtured heart approach impacts ADHD. So I'm really excited about that because I'd love to, best case scenario, there's some controversial results that show that, maybe we've been misconstruing these kids who are, measure poorly on the Connors. And maybe how is it that 2 months later, they're not only back to normal, they're above normal?
I think often the kids who are being labeled as hyperactive and inattentive and so on are among our most creative kids who are going to do some of the most interesting things when they grow up, providing they don't get their brains ruined along the way and get labeled and discouraged. I really believe that's not a romanticization.
Well, I know you do. Well, you're the voice of that, Peter. And I think we're both equally concerned that, a child fits some description of symptomatology, and no doubt some symptoms drive people crazy and alarm them and concern them. And the way it is still to this day is that if a child fits that symptomatology, they wind up on medication. And my thing is, why I don't like that message to kids, which is something's wrong with your life force. We can't handle it. You can't handle it. We need to make it go away. And the only way we know how to moderate it is by medication. If the work I do, changes the conversation on whether medication is a first resort, I'll be happy. Best case scenario, these kids, we find some really exciting results and people start having that conversation. And instead of having no recourse, that, there's all of a sudden there is a possibility for people who don't want to summarily put their kids on medication. Maybe doctors will change the way they look at things someday.
Well, I don't know if that's going to happen very much, but I think it's going to be more that psychologists like yourself and other people with occasional medical doctors are going to lead into new directions. And the doctors are going to have to find somebody else to drug.
That's interesting. Don't you think you've made some dents over all these years, Peter?
Well, I mean, I haven't been asked that in a while in public. I certainly have made huge dents in influencing psychologists and social workers and counselors. I have certainly influenced some psychiatrists around the world and some pediatricians mm-hmm. around the world. Mm-hmm. But the problem is you've got to be so brave as a psychiatrist nowadays that you're going to actually learn to, you'll have to, if you come and look at what you're doing and admit how bad it is, then you're going to have to find another way to have an identity, to make a living, to be proud of yourself, and so on and so forth. And it involves pretty much being alienated from the people that you considered your colleagues since you were a young person. So I think it's going to be very, very hard. I think people are just going to have to stop going. And I think I'm definitely having an effect there. And not just me, of course, but many, many people who've been influenced by me. I think that your views on drugs are somewhat influenced by me. I think you also came to them on your own.
Absolutely. No, I am absolutely one of your students and highly influenced by you.
Yeah. But psychiatry, I think, will just get worse and worse as people start more and more to be critical.
Really?
And the drug companies, you see, it's not even about psychiatry anymore. It's about the big industries. Psychiatry now is just an arm of the pharmaceutical empire. It depended completely on the pharmaceutical industry. And that's just going to rev up its control efforts, its attempts to lie and cheat, to try to make drugs look useful when they're not, to cover up the fact that all these psychoactive drugs are actually very serious neurotoxins. And I just did a blog on that, Howie. It's had, excuse me, it's had over 6,000 viewers in a couple of weeks. I wish it would go viral, but it's about, you know, saying these drugs are neurotoxins. But no, I don't think we're going to see great changes in psychiatry. When I took on the lobotomists in the 70s, I stopped almost all the lobotomy going on and psychosurgery, brain mutilation, psychiatric neurosurgical brain mutilation going on in the Western world. But the Psychiatric Association continued to align itself and defend the lobotomists. What stopped them was nothing internal. In fact, I don't think a well-known professor of psychiatry, a single one, joined me over that five-year campaign to support me in criticizing lobotomy, even when I found out that they were doing experimental brain surgery on black children in a segregated institution in Mississippi. This is back in the 70s I was doing this. Even then, it was hard to get professionals of any race to come forward if they had prestige in the community, even psychologists, African-American psychologists. There were more psychologists in their identity than they were African-American. And these professional identities are so strong, it's very hard for people to let go of them, find other ways to be proud of themselves, to make a living, to know their greatness, as you would say. But I was able to influence enough lawyers and lay people and great psychologists like Bert Caron, who came to support me very early on. And Bill Glasser was a psychiatrist, but he'd been against drugs before I was. He just never went out and made a big issue about it. He's a little older than me.
Yeah.
So, and the changes from within a profession like that are very difficult. I'm seeing more and more that it's the same.
You're saying it's more the groundswell. You're saying it's more the people are going to come, are coming to, the profession will die a natural death out of a groundswell of people who have found their way to different answers, just like food industry is changing, you know, from the inside out because people are eating differently.
Well, I think it's a great, I was actually going to bring that analogy up because I'm working a lot with nutritionist Pam Popper, and we've been holding joint conferences for a couple of years now. And she and I have just done a film on how to withdraw from psychiatric drugs. It's a course. It's a big course. It's just coming to an end.
Awesome.
It's first time out.
Awesome.
And it's mostly for professionals. But the same thing is in the food industry. The meat people are not going to cave in on their own. The milk and eggs people are not going to, on their own, just decide, well, they're going to go and roll over wheat, corn, potatoes, and reuse their land in ways
that makes total sense. That makes your statements on psychiatry make total sense. And I get it. I get it. You know, the way I came to have my interesting views on medication is, you know, when I went into practice and when this approach started hatching in me, and I started seeing that the same kids who would summarily be put on medication, if I caught them before medication, they, you know, 3 months or less later, they were using their intensity well. And then there was a slew of kids I worked with who were already on medication, and I got to see that they could come out on the other side. And at some point, if the parent, and you know, I never told anybody to go off medication, but but often on their own, parents would say, hey, I got it now. I understand how my kid ticks. I know how to parent this kid, and I get that I'm having an impact, and this kid is using their intensity well. And they would approach the doctors, and they would say, my child's ready to come off medication. You know, and they, you know, most of the time they could find their way to somebody who would help in that. And you know, as you know, I've sent some people your way because, you know, it's not always the easiest thing to find somebody who's shorthanded like you are.
Yeah, you know, thinking about changing, one of the things I noticed when I first met you was that you were publicly aligning yourself with me early in your career when the only possible reason to have done it at that point was because you believed in not drugging kids and you weren't going to become a successful psychologist who avoided those subjects and just, you know, found better ways to help kids without saying the drugs are harmful. So, I mean, that is very unusual. I mean,
I didn't realize that, Peter.
Go ahead.
I didn't realize that. I like I said before, you know, I came to my views organically. I wasn't necessarily philosophically against medications from the get-go. I worked with psychiatrists. When my daughter was born, I took a job as a case manager, and I had to attend all these medication evaluations and reviews, and they were nice people. I knew them as nice people. I just came to see that most of the time medications could either be avoided or were not necessary at some point. And that's when I started looking at or hearing more about you. And then once I started looking at your work and having my eyes open to the nature of this industry and the nature of psychiatry and the nature, you know, not to make them bad, mean people. It's just, you know, I'm assuming everybody on the planet means well and is trying to be loving in their own ways. But, you know, how many times did I see a doctor encountering a child who was symptomatic and all they had in their bag of tricks was medication A through Z? And that's all they knew. They didn't have an alternative.
Yeah, absolutely. But I also don't think that all people are well-intentioned. All people probably tell themselves that on some level they're well-intentioned. I'm sure the most violent and hateful dictators on earth are convinced they're a gift to their country. But in fact, people are often driven by hate, by violence, by a desire to control. And I think some very controlling, angry human beings find an outlet by being psychiatrists. So, you know, I'm not too much into this nice people thing. I think people are a mixed bag. I think the Bible told us that. The Iliad and the Odyssey tell us that. And there are good folks. There are bad folks. There are people who are so out for themselves they hurt other human beings. There are people who sacrifice themselves for other human beings, and so on. So I'm unlike you, I'm just not too much into this everybody means well. I think everybody...
Kumbaya. We're not going to be singing Kumbaya today.
But listen, wonderful, and I think it's a great spirit to bring to patients and the clients we help. I mean, Ginger points out often that I get more easily taken advantage of by people than she does because my whole life as a therapist, going back to 18 years old and working in the state mental hospital wards as a volunteer, I've always tried to find the goodness in people and reach out to it and to encourage it. And so sometimes, once in a while, I can be taken advantage of because I'm always trying to find the best to relate to in a person. But the truth is that a lot of people can't be trusted, but not many of them come for therapy. They're the people who are driving the other people into therapy.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, that sort of stopped the show a little bit, Howard.
It's food for thought for me, and I honor your point of view, and medicine, and I don't. But I'm happy to say I will kind of carve out a little path. Is the last 3 years I've been privileged to teach at Andrew Weil's program to integrative residents of integrative medicine. And, you know, so every year I'm meeting 60 or 80 new doctors. And I'm only doing a 2-hour little carve out on what I do, but it's getting rave reviews, and they keep wanting me to come back and see the next cohort of doctors. So there are people who are coming along who like Pam, see the beauty of food and ancillary therapies, and see the world in a broader way, and so medicine does have some long term rays of hope.
Well, I think that Andrew Weil is, a man who's really been on the frontier, and I know people who have taken his program, physicians, and they're just doing very, very good work. So I'm not saying there aren't good people out there. I know tons of good people. I mean, probably just about everybody listening to us right now is a really good human being. I'm talking about whether the people get attracted into and even changed by doing things that are bad for people. I think psychiatrists get drawn into nowadays much more. In the old days, psychiatrists were often people who who'd had therapy and wanted to help people. Probably 10% of the profession at one point was doing psychotherapy, at least. Now, of course, it's just about zero. And it's a different person that's drawn into psychiatry than into counseling or psychotherapy and other more empathic viewpoints of human beings.
Yeah.
One of the things that sort of relates to this is, one of the issues that comes up in regard to your work is the very simplicity of it. And I think that's worth addressing, because you have developed an approach which I imagine is not hard to teach. I think people can get it. I think it will show very, very rapid results. But shouldn't things be much more complicated than that?
I'm just following what I've been given. You know, people ask me, they want to, I've had any number of people who want to point out the academic links to what I'm saying and what I'm teaching. And that's all fine and good. But that's not how this was born. It was really just given to me out of my deep desire, maybe my passion, to help these families. Because, I was one of these kids. I wasn't put on medication because I grew up before all that hoopla, but I would have in a heartbeat been one of those kids. I saw how it damaged my relationship with my parents. I saw how it was irretrievable damage at some point. So I saw how I emerged from childhood, as a good kid stuck in a bad pattern, and I couldn't get out of it on my own. And as a young adult, I had I basically could have died 100 times over by the way I lived my life. So I take it very seriously. And I guess I was selected by the universe to be this person, because I kept getting these downloads of, here's the next chapter. I wasn't planning on birthing an approach, Peter, and I wasn't planning on it being either complicated or simple. It just came the way it came. But in retrospect, I love that it was simple. And I love that people from all walks of life, you know, who so many people are, you know, maybe the quiet epidemic, Peter, is that there are so many families, you know, so many people of whether they're rich, poor, or in between, who are suffering the loss of relationship with their kids, and either hanging on for dear life or severely worried about their kids, and it, you know, and they don't have any parenting tools that are getting them any closer to a solution, and you know, so people. In for many reasons, find their way to looking for answers. And I'm happy if somebody finds their way to what I do. I feel like I can help do some repair. I could help. I think the problem is, and I didn't say this earlier, is that normal, traditional, conventional approaches really aren't a good fit for the kinds of kids that we're, you know, talking about. And they may not be a good fit for this today's world. Because everything, pretty much everything you read about in the normal parlance of things is, you know, say thank you, good job, when things are going well. And when things are going poorly, that's when you teach them the lessons. That's when you sit down with them and you say, you know, Samantha, that wasn't a good choice. I want you to think about this. Let's talk about it. And you know, that may go well for some kids, but if it's a child with more intensity, look out. If that child starts putting two and two together, that they get, you know, albeit through negativity, they get sweeter, deeper connection with their important people in their lives, they're prone to just falling sway into that, Peter. And, you know, so I may not be answering your question about simplicity. You know, I'll give you an example of the simplicity. After dropping out of my last bit of doctoral work, thinking I'm just going to live my childhood dream of being a cabinet maker for a few years, and then I'll go back and finish my dissertation, 15 years later, I have a family and I get back into being a family therapist and, I'm trying, you know, the approaches that I learned in school and maybe I had new eyes and I didn't have the same kind of loyalty a graduate student has to each and every approach. But if something didn't work, I let it drop away and pretty soon I had nothing. It was just me and the family. And I saw that there were things parents said to kids, unbeknownst to them, that were helpful, that energetically moved the child. And I saw that, unbeknownst to the parent, there were things they said that maligned themselves with the child, that pushed the child away. And so I started to see things from this energetic point of view, and I desperately wanted to explain what I was seeing. And I wake up in the middle of the night with the following story. And I went in the next day and I tried it with several families and they sat up and like a lightning rod went through them. And they said, oh my God, that makes sense. So here's the story. I call it Toys R Us. I think we're our kids' favorite toy. Think about how kids are when they get a new toy. And, you know, they usually drop everything they're doing and they unwrap it as fast as they can and they go into explore mode and they, you know, start checking out every feature of the toy. And some features are hopefully exciting and compelling. And those are the ones they stick with. And some features might be boring and, you know, they may go back to a boring feature by accident or on purpose. But if it remains boring, they write it off and they stick to the exciting features. How many features do we have? How many? You know, maybe unlimited. Maybe, you know, it's, you know, all the movements and the ways we navigate our being, our body through the, you know, and along with our moods and our emotions and its unique emotions. You know, Peter's got his emotions and you never have the same emotion twice. You may, you may be categorically frustrated 8 days in a row, but it's always going to be different. And so, you know, we may be the ultimate entertainment center. And you know, so I think from day one, kids are drinking in energetic impressions of how the world works and inevitably their impact on the world. You know, so I'm a baby with a little rattle, and you can't get it away from me without me screaming for many months of my life. But one day the rattle goes flying, and a person comes, sees it, picks it up, delivers it, and with a coochie-coo, gives me the rattle, and I look at them and look at the rattle, and I toss it, you know. And now I'm seeing my impact on the world. Fast forward, show me a kid with a little more neediness, a little more intensity, a little more sensitivity in a normal classroom or a normal home governed by normal, conventional, traditional approaches, and I'll show you a kid who's prone to seeing the truth, which is these toys, us, are so much more interesting when things are going wrong than when things are going right. When things are going right, we're boring. We say thank you and good job, maybe. And when things go wrong, that's when we sit down and spend time and have so much to say and we get so emotional. You know, so this story, Toys R Us, has been bedrock of my approach. It's been a starting point for how I explain this approach. And how simple is that? I mean, it's not based on, you know, these complicated scientific premises. It's based on this weird story.
Oh, it's a wonderful story. It's a wonderful, wonderful story. And I think by taking such a positive approach to children, our charisma for those that the children feel around us, their desire to please us and to model on us just goes up greatly, because we're just so much bigger and wonderful when we are being positive to children than when we're being negative. So I think it's so health-giving to the therapist. That would be a very interesting study to do. But I'll bet anything that nurtured heart approach therapists are happier than therapists on average. I'll bet anything.
Ah, well, that would be a great study. Let's do that study. I think you're right, because, you know, I know many people who are so smart and they studied so arduously and they so wanted to live their dream of being a good therapist, and they're miserable. You know, they listen to people's problems all day long, and they, you know, some of them get miserable, you know, physical disorders from taking on people's, negativity, and they're not having results. They wonder when are we going to get results? And some people, I met this woman who wound up being a co-author, who was incredibly bright person, who said she was on the verge, the dirty little secret was she was on the verge of quitting so many times because she wasn't seeing results. And I was a supervisor when I taught her nurtured heart approach, and she had nothing but success with these families. All of a sudden she was having success 100% of the time. And so I bet you're right. I never would have thought of that study.
Yeah, and it's not just because of the success, which does come with it, knowing better how to relate to and attach to a child in a positive way. It's just the healthiness of being positive and caring. I tell my clients, my patients, that I can't be crazy all day long, because my whole orientation is to caring about what I'm doing and to caring about the people I'm seeing. And if they learn that, if they learn to just really in a positive way approach the people in their lives, their lives are just going to get better and better. That doesn't mean you'll still be happy with your wife or your husband. It might make things worse. You get positive and the other person gets negative on you. But with a child, that's not going to happen.
And what you're saying is really important, because I think when you grow in your greatness, when, you know, positivity has its own, just like negativity has its own downward spiral, positivity has an upward spiral. And people I know who take the route of positivity seem to grow in their greatness. And one thing, one side effect of that is, you move the needle of your greatness and all of a sudden things start resolving themselves. And all of a sudden you see, no, I don't want to have a relationship with that person who makes me miserable. Or, you know, you get clear about everything.
Oh, absolutely. That's extraordinarily important. And while I did mention earlier that maybe approaching people as a therapist, very positive, looking for what's good, you may get somewhat taken advantage of. But actually, by and large, if you're approaching people positively, negative people get uncomfortable, and they actually will tend to leave you alone in your social life. Positive people draw to each other.
I couldn't agree more. I agree fully. It almost is like there's a dissolution of those kinds of things coming your way. They dissolve in front of your eyes.
Yeah.
Things that were formerly problems are no longer problems, or they're easily solvable.
Think about stuff to tell the folks before we finish.
Okay.
We've got maybe, I don't know, 7 minutes left or something. First, which of your books would you like people to read?
You know, the first book is probably the bedrock of what I've written. It's called Transforming the Difficult Child. And then this last year, I did a very deep revision of that, so it's in really good shape. And, of course, you did the foreword to that book, so I feel blessed. I wrote a companion workbook that's really wonderful, and it really holds somebody's hand through learning the approach, and it has just the right amount of support and challenges. I waited for years to find the right workbook design, and that's called Transforming the Intense Child, and that's the workbook. I would say those are the two I would recommend. And if somebody's listening to this, Peter, and they simply want to apply the approach to themselves, which I have done for 20 years now, so I've been the guinea pig. I would say one of my books called Igniting Greatness is the one. It kind of takes the inner journey of Nurtured Heart Approach. And I'm excited that I'm actually building a program based on that now. I've started a mentoring program. People can come study with me what I recommend is they read a book or they take an online seminar, and then they, if they like it and experiment with it and see the merits of it and the promise of it, then one thing I do is I do week-long certification trainings. And they've been really wonderful, because we now really empower people. We give them all the PowerPoints they need. We give them all the materials they need to go out and teach the approach. So it's changed a lot of careers, and those are the people who are out in their smaller communities, you know, teaching in places I could never ever reach. So I feel very blessed by all the, 3,000 people have come and become certified trainers of Nurtured Heart Approach, which is
wild. What's your website for folks who want to learn about, coming to your conferences, coming to your training, reading your books?
Yeah, it's Children's Success ChildrensSuccessFoundation.com, ChildrensSuccessFoundation.com, and two alternative ways to get redirected to that site. If you forget that long name and you do DifficultChild.com or HowardGlasser.com, either one of those will redirect you to Children's Success Foundation.
I've been invited to talk. I think as the only person who was not actually working in your organization or teaching or training in your organization, I got to meet a lot of folks when I talked at your conference. And it's a happy group. It's a very happy group, a very creative group. It's a group of people who really enjoy each other. Howie's passion for people and delight with people just shines over it. So you're not gonna harm yourself in any way, and you'll likely learn and enjoy yourself.
Well, I want to come to one of your conferences again one of these days. Whenever the time is right, let me know, and I'll see if I could make it. I'd love to join forces with you and be amongst your people too, because I love your people.
Well, that's great. Well, let's talk about that, and
okay.
We'll get to share some more ideas, maybe even about nutrition and food, because that has really, as my listeners know, is really transforming my life and my wife's life, and a number of our friends and some of my clients. As we, it's been a lifelong dream of mine that I thought I wasn't good enough to do, which was to move toward plant-based diet and cut back on meat and cut back on...
There you go. Peter Bragan, me too. Me too.
Yes.
I'm essentially vegan at this point.
Well, when did you start?
You know, it's been on and off for 30 years, but it really is, it's really from the inside out. I've been waiting until it felt like it wasn't just me superimposing it on myself, which I would have rebelled against. It's really coming from deep inside me that I want to eat plant-based foods, and it's such a better connection now. So I would say in the last year.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I've lost 30 pounds since April, so it's pretty new for me.
Peter.
Ginger's
Yay.
Lost about 20. Hey, listen, everybody out there, Howie Glasser is a wonderful, wonderful friend, a good man. Your association with him would always help you in your life. And Howie, let's do get together professionally more, and have a great
yes.
new year, my friend.
Yes, love to you and Ginger. So glad to hear all the good things.
Okay. Well, bye, folks. Tune in next week. We got a great guest next week, and as we always do. Bye-bye now.